I am holding in my hands right now copies of the majestic 12 documents. They are absolutely riveting. I've got two books in my hand of these documents. And I've got to tell you, if somebody put these together fraudulently, he or she did one incredibly thorough job to try to deceive people. These look as authentic as anything I've ever seen. In a moment, Bob Wood, Ryan Wood join us as we talk about disclosure on Coast to Coast AM. Two spectacular guests for you tonight. Bob Wood, Dr. Robert Wood, PhD, former aerospace engineer, who has spent years investigating a leaked government training manual for UFO crash retrieval that he believes is authentic. Dr. Wood has applied his talents to becoming familiar with forensic documentation authentication and has been the executive producer of a television documentary about the evidence for the recovery and retrieval of downed UFOs. Bob Wood. Hey, Bob, how are you? Welcome to Coast again.
Thank you, George. I'm great.
Always a pleasure. And also, ufologist, researcher, author Ryan Wood has taught college courses and made numerous presentations about UFOs to civic organizations and ufology conferences. Ryan is now regarded as a leading authority on the top-secret classified Majestic 12 intelligence documents and also the 1941 Cape Girardeau, Missouri UFO crash site. Back on Coast to Coast, Ryan Wood. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, George. It's great to be here.
So is it a coincidence that both of you have the same last name, Ryan?
It is a coincidence.
Related. Father-son team. Here they are. And Ryan, you were with me not too long ago, but Bob, you haven't been on the program in a long time, so welcome back.
Thank you. Yes, it's good to be here.
Give us, Bob, first of all, an overall of these documents. What are they?
Well, there's 4,000 pages that range all the way from top-secret classified code word documents, several hundred of them, to just ordinary manuals that somebody had in their safe that they wanted to get rid of. So, but they have amazing inference about our history of studying this problem over the years.
What got you interested in researching this?
Well, it began years and years ago when I was working at McDonnell Douglas, and my boss asked me to explain to the Air Force how 10 years from then we'd go to the airport, go into space and back. And so just for a joke, I said, well, why don't you tell them how the alleged UFOs do it? And he said, that's a great idea. Why don't you work on that? So that's how I started. And after I'd read 50 books, I concluded, hey, there was no doubt that these were real craft and they were piloted by real people. So we did a little project to study it. And after we couldn't figure out the answer, why we quit. But after I retired in 1994, I got exposed to the Special Operations Manual that Stan Friedman, who's another researcher, had been given a copy of and said, hey, I know you retired. You don't have anything to do. Would you be interested in taking a look at authenticating this? And so that's how I really started the authentication end of studying the UFO problem.
And as you know, McDonnell Douglas was headquartered in St. Louis until they were bought out by Boeing. And, you know, now we have the military division here of Boeing. Great company, great St. Louis company, Bob.
Right, right. Mr. McDonnell was interested in anomaly kinds of things, too.
As you made those circles around McDonnell Douglas, did you hear stories of crashed UFOs from people that you respected?
Actually, no, not within the company. But after I retired, I talked to people who were willing to talk to me. I think, see, the fact that I was knowledgeable in this kind of spread. And so if anybody had some real inside information, they would have avoided me like the plague. So I think that's why I didn't learn while I was working there.
And Ryan, what got you interested? Watching Dad do his work, or were you already doing that?
Well, I think I got early exposure when I was like, 11 or 12, when he started to read his 50 books. And then I sort of had the passing interest for quite some time until the Special Operations Manual came out in 94 and paid more attention. And then when the Tim Cooper documents came out in the middle 90s to late 90s and early 2000, Those were really a lot of interesting documents that you could really plug your or sink your teeth into and study and work at, and that got me more and more excited.
We're going to get into a lot of this and the procedure for our authentication, but you've got to tell us a little bit, Ryan, about the Cape Girardeau, Missouri crash. My son went to college in Cape Girardeau, so that area has always fascinated me. 1947 was Roswell. This was 1941.
That's right. It was 1941. And I think it was Stan Friedman that read some of these Majestic documents and noticed the comment about the 1941 Missouri recovery, and then remembered that Leonard Stringfield had a witness that talked about the UFO crash in Missouri in 41. And then we finally found Charlotte Mann, who was the granddaughter of Reverend Huffman, who was, took the deathbed testimony of her grandmother, which recounted the full details of a crash and the military and alien bodies and all being in Cape Girardeau.
I tried years ago to look for the sheriff of that region. I could not find him because I'm told he had a lot of information about this.
The question is, was it... There's two sheriffs, Shady, S-C-H-A-D-E, I think, and he died. But his brother, actually, we interviewed on the phone maybe 5 years ago, and he wasn't very forthcoming, but he confirmed that there was weird things that happened. So it was sort of a weak confirmation, but it was definitely a confirmation in my mind.
Bob, now take us through the authentication process. How do you even start that?
Well, let me jump in and just say one thing about the Cape Girardeau crash.
Sure.
And that is that I think it's so significant that if you imagine in 1941 we might have had a craft in our hands, that would have given us many more years before the discovery of the transistor to think about that. And so plant that seed in your mind as a possibility of the beginnings of the process of trying to do the reverse engineering. But the answer to question on starting to authenticate documents kind of begins with asking, do you have an original? If you have an original copy from earlier times, then you can look at the paper and ask, is it watermarked? You can find out what kind of paper it is. You can have the original ink. You can punch out little tiny holes and put the ink in a library of ink comparison so you can date the ink. If you have a typewritten document, you can compare the type with a whole battery of typewriters and typewriter exemplars. And so those are the kinds of things that you can proceed with. Now, normally that requires a laboratory to do that. And so in our case, we've hired a laboratory to do some of this more technological work.
Did you find any inconsistencies, Bob, of these documents compared to documents of that era?
No, not at all. In fact, one of the classic documents, the Eisenhower briefing document, a typewriter font was in agreement with a 1940 typewriter the government would have used. And in particular, when we looked at the special operations manual printing, which we might talk about later, we found that it was totally consistent with the print being in use for hot lead printing presses of that era.
Now, the documents we're looking at, and I've got two books in my hand. Tell me about the smaller book, Extraterrestrial Entities and Technology, Recovery and Disposal.
Yeah, that's the Special Operations Manual, and the book you had in your hand is a replica of what it looked like, 6x9, in the days that it was being used. April 1954 is the date on it, and then actually there are witnesses, there are people who claim to have held a copy of this real book in their hand who study the subject. But this book was really exciting to me because the authentication of the date was not only confirmed by the type font aberration, actually a raised Z at one particular point. But it was confirmed by the use of the language. The the linguistics had some words. For instance, screwdriver in the mid-50s was two separate words. And first aid was initial caps. And now today, it's not that way. So it kind of dates the book just from the language. They even used a craft tape to describe a kind of tape. So it clearly was a book that was printed in 1954, just like it says on the cover. And so the skeptics have a real big trouble trying to say that it was a modern fake.
Give us your theory, Bob, on this book, this training manual. What happened, and why did they decide to put it together?
Well, actually, it says in the manual to give a better understanding for what's going on to those people who are involved in the recovery. It doesn't try to provide a detailed instructions to everybody, but just enough about the history of the program so that the people who are involved will understand. In my opinion, we began a process in 1941 and 42 when we started to get more UFOs being recovered to aggressively try to get them. And I think it's not even out of the question that we maybe at White Sands tried to shoot some of them down. But in any case, we had a regular process in place. And it seemed sensible to put out a manual to describe how to keep the public in the dark, how to recover the craft, how to recover the bodies, how to make sure that we didn't expose ourselves to any alien viruses, where to ship the parts and the bodies, and all that's in this manual. So it was a perfectly reasonable thing to put out a carefully controlled, limited number of copies of a manual to those very few people in the country who had the job of recovering the craft and getting hold of the problem.
Who do you think put the manual together, or what agency?
I think it was the CIA at this particular time.
Some control group inside the CIA. It was responsible for this particular problem. And the reason why we say that is that there's a mention of the Central Intelligence in the document. It just says Central Intelligence, not Central Intelligence Agency.
Right.
And this is a subtlety, subtle arrogance that at this time it's just Central Intelligence. We're above an agency, so to speak.
That's right. It's on a page that actually has the shapes of the craft that had been seen as of 1953.
Yeah.
It is remarkable.
And it's so nuanced and so delicate. You know, it's that little bit of forensic linguistics there by using two words, Central Intelligence versus Central Intelligence Agency, that just gives you that extra touch that, wow, this is either done by the CIA to fool somebody or done by the KGB with a lot of PhDs and a lot of thinking for some geopolitical purpose, or it's real.
Actually, I think that the Central Intelligence Agency as an entity was hardly involved in any detail, but the counterintelligence part of it under James Jesus Angleton was the one that was deeply involved. So the main agency really had no clue, just as they have no clue today, that this is really going on. But a tiny part of it, the corner of it, the counterintelligence, was managing this program, in my opinion, covertly.
It's also possible, Bob and Ryan, that we had an organization, a specific organization, like we have Navy SEALs who are trained to do specific tasks. I bet we had a very black ops group that this manual might have been written for.
Indeed.
Oh, yeah, right, exactly.
They just said, all right, and they did training programs with them, and, I don't know what the grouping number could have been, but they went all over the country.
Well, one of the documents, we have the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit summary in 1947 kind of alludes to some of the personnel from Sandia as being involved in the recovery. And those were some of the people who actually became ill in contact with some of the aliens that were, I think, part of the recovery group.
Have you ever had a whistleblower who knew of someone or who might have been part of this organization?
Well, I guess there's two answers to that. And one is the person that leaked the, many of the documents, Thomas Cantwheel, a pseudonym. He said he was part of this Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit group. The other thing of note is that at some of the conferences that Bob and Terry Brown put on in Laughlin, Nevada, they had a whistleblower that was behind the blacked out face that went on and talked about, yeah, I was in the pits, I was decontaminating crashed saucers, I was part of these teams, but it wasn't on the record officially other than just, you know, his testimony behind a mask.
But a good example of that is just in the last week, I got a letter from the son of a whistleblower who was talking about what his dad had said with respect to the recovery of a crashed object in February 1942 during the Battle of L.A. So this is the first time I've ever had a direct confirmation that we indeed did recover a craft after the Battle of L.A. other than the leaked documents that I'd had before. So I think the whistleblower's children are the ones who maybe are the only ones who can tell us now, because the whistleblowers are dying.
Yeah, you may be right about that, and they must have some information that must be riveting, truly. Ryan, in some of your work, what is a UFO DEX?
Well, when I think about the long-term problem of ufology, it's one of ultimate credibility with the public. And the challenge is either you have to provide an alien cadaver on the table, or pieces of crashed wreckage, or presidents that are willing to testify under oath. All those things would really change the paradigm. The other thing that would change the paradigm that was within my grasp and control was to create an archive of documents, in essence, a library, a fully text-searchable library of all UFO knowledge. There's only a couple thousand books in ufology. There's a few thousand hours of videotape. There's newspaper articles and magazines and journals and so forth, but getting that all into one spot and getting it all full text searchable so you can just log in like Google or log into UFODEX and search it would create a form of disclosure. Everybody would have the same information. It could be more easily correlated and understood. And that's something that I'm working on, and it's not ready for launch yet, but it's coming in months.
And will it revolutionize this industry?
I sure hope so. I think it'll give everybody, all your listeners, all the media and press, the access to the same level of knowledge that is in the rare and obscure libraries of my father's garage or Stan Friedman's garage and filing, or Linda Moulton Howe's archives, or Jim Mars's archives, all these different repositories of rare knowledge that are hidden could all be accessed and then correlated, and people could come up to speed about the history and the thought processes of ufology and this phenomenon.
All right, Ryan, we'll be back with you and with Bob Wood in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Now, keep playing with the coasttocoastam.com website. The beta version, as every day, it's getting closer to total perfection. I hope you enjoy it. And when we come back, we'll be chatting with Bob Wood, Ryan Wood. Their websites are linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. Bob and Ryan, let's talk a little bit about the craft that was illustrated in the manual, the entities, and also whether they told us where they were coming from. But the craft in general, Bob, how many different versions of craft were there?
Well, in this particular manual, there were four different shapes. There was a typical saucer-shaped circular one, and the long cigar-shaped one, a triangular-shaped one, which actually was recently reported in 1999 over Phoenix, and then a kind of an ice cream cone-shaped one that is less often reported. But at that time, there were those four. And, of course, since then, those same four shapes have been reported, plus many others.
Did they talk about the reverse engineering?
No. At no time does this manual talk about reverse engineering. The only reference to reverse engineering comes in documents that allude to the code word Jehovah, which seems to be relatable to some of Einstein's involvement. So my impression is that the reverse engineering program was more tightly controlled.
Yeah, I think it was classified in a different area. There is some other Majestic documents that have some early descriptions of fiber optics, in essence, plastic cladding type wrap inside flying saucers, glass rods, things like that. It is interesting to note in the Special Operations Manual, there's a page on what to do with various items. And they have aircraft, intact device, damaged device, power plants, fragments, unidentified fragments, provisions, living entity, non-living entity, weapons, things like that. It's clearly they're collecting these things, and it's logical to believe they would be focusing on reverse engineering it.
Do they talk about where they take the craft once they find it?
Yeah, they have specific locations depending on whether it's propulsion or whether it's structure. And, in fact, some of the locations were Area 51, S4.
Right, and the Blue Lab at Wright-Patterson 61.
Yeah, that was for the remains. There were two kinds of aliens described, EBE-1 and EBE-2, extraterrestrial biological entity is what that stands for. And I hired a forensic artist to draw on the basis of what this manual said, what they looked like. And, of course, you can't describe that over the phone very well, but...
give it your best shot, Robert.
Yeah. Well, one of them was the little grays with the big wraparound eyes. The other one was and kind of lightweight, like maybe 30, 40 pounds. The other one was more like 80 pounds and more like 5 feet tall, perhaps, but with a face that was sort of normal, with eyes that were sort of normal, too.
Okay. Almost human-looking.
Yeah, right.
The document says EBE type 1, these entities are humanoid and might be mistaken for human beings of an oriental race. If seen from a distance, they are bipedal, 5 feet 5 inches tall, weight 80 to 100 pounds. Proportionally, they're similar to humans, although the cranium is somewhat larger and more rounded. The skin is pale, chalky yellow in color, thick with slightly pebbled appearance. And it goes on.
Did they talk of where they may have come from?
No, not at all in this document. And in fact, I think in sort of scanning my mind, all the documents that I have for evaluation and authentication, I don't think I have any report of any statements or claims of where they came from. On the other hand, there's a lot of literature out there, but none of it associated with leaked documents for authentication that I'm working on.
Is that unusual that would not be in this manual?
Yeah, I don't think that's a problem. I don't think it's unexpected because the purpose of this manual was really to make sure that the crew knew what they were trying to do, namely to get the parts to the right spots and to get them there reliably. They weren't trying to explain to the recovery crews what the program was all about.
Bob, did they talk about viruses, to try to be careful of
Actually,
disease?
This manual does not, but the first reference to that actually occurred in July 1947 when it was clear that we lost the lives of three of the technicians from handling the aliens. And that was right in one of the question documents.
Yeah. Tell me more about that.
Well, I can actually just read you the couple of sentences that that relate to that.
Mantle was concerned over the contamination of several SED or Sandia Engineering District personnel upon coming in contact with a debris near a nuclear power plant. One technician was overcome and collapsed when he attempted the removal of the body. Another medical technician went into coma 4 hours after placing the body in a rubber body bag. All four were rushed to Los Alamos for observation. All four later died of seizures and profuse bleeding. All four were wearing protective suits when they came in contact with the body fluids from the occupants.
There's another section of another document that says the most disturbing aspect of this investigation was there were other bodies found not far from LZ-1 that looked as if they'd been dissected as you would a frog. It's not known if Army field surgeons had performed exploratory surgery on these bodies. Animal parts were reportedly discovered inside the craft at LZ-2, but this cannot be confirmed. The team has reserved judgment on this issue. So this leads to the whole issue also early on of the animal mutilations that have been, I'm sure, reported on your show.
Here's one more short sentence. Autopsies of the four dead SED technicians were not conclusive. It is believed that the four may have suffered from some form of toxin or highly contagious disease. Tissue samples are currently being kept at Fort Detrick, Maryland.
That is amazing. It's also frightening.
Well, I think that the death of the personnel was one of the major reasons for keeping this program so secret, to worry about. And also to apply it potentially to biological warfare uses. You really can't separate biological warfare from this issue.
That's true. Go ahead, Brian.
And there's actually, in the first annual report of the Majestic documents, there's a section on government policy of control and denial. One of the most difficult aspects of controlling the perception in the public's mind of the government's attempts at denial and ignorance is actual control underlined of the press. Until a clear intent is established with diplomatic relations firmly in hand, it is the recommendation of the President's special panel and a concurrence from Majestic 12 that a policy of strict denial of the events surfacing from Roswell, New Mexico, and any other incidents of such caliber be enforced. An interactive program of controlled releases to the media in such a fashion to discredit any civilian investigation be instituted in accordance with the provisions of the 1947 National Security Act. That wasn't quite on point. There was another one here on biological warfare programs, which was more to the Bob's earlier mention. BW biological warfare programs in the U.S. and the U.K. are in field test stages. Discovery of a new virus and bacteria agents so lethal that serums derived by genetic research could launch genetic research of the aliens could launch medical science into unheard of fields of biology. The samples extracted from bodies found in New Mexico, the alien bodies, have yielded new strains of retro-hyphen virus or backward virus. Not totally understood, but give the promise of the ultimate biological weapon.
I wonder if any of that has been leaked on anybody over the years, Ryan and Bob.
I'm sure it has.
Was there ever any concern in the documents about these ETs returning to get their craft or to get their, they're dead?
I'm trying to remember whether there was a case. I think it might be one case, I don't remember really in the documents that I have of a good example of that.
I don't think there is, and if these are really disposable biological robots or probes that are, you know, like ants to us.
Right. At least the little ones.
Yeah. That there's no reason. It's a human attribute to care about our children or care about people in ill health or to have that notion. And I think the aliens don't think that way. They're the uber logical. These are disposable biological cyborgs, and I don't want to go pick them up. There's no value in doing it.
See, I, if I were running things, would have said, we better be careful. They're coming back to get this stuff.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, I'd come back for the craft at least, but I guess not.
Well, I don't have any documents on it, but there have many people have written who have researched the subject from the looking at the media and other reports that there have been times when we've been in effect at war. You know, we've had fighter pilots up there trying to shoot them down, and we lost dozens of airplanes in 1 year, I think 65 or so. That's written up in a book that has come out in the last year or so, talking about the combat, the situations between our Air Force and also the Soviet Air Force and the ET craft. So that was pretty well concealed by not releasing the circumstances of the loss of the pilots by the government.
Bob, if these documents are frauds, you do not believe that. You believe they're authentic. But if they are, what kind of a person and what kind of background and training would he have to put one of these things together?
Well, the idea that these documents were fraudulently prepared is just almost inconceivable, because they are so interwoven and interconnected in unexpected ways that you really would have had to have known a large number of obscure facts about the history of our country and our government in order to get all those facts linked so accurately. I mean,
And you'd also have to understand documents and how they were typed and everything else.
Yeah, that's right. You'd have to. Now, on the other hand, the people who are in the intelligence business said that, well, you know, there are organizations such as parts of the CIA who have a group that prepares documents intentionally, falsely. And you even imagine a group like that with old pens and old pencils that have been saved for 20 years, you know, so they'll test properly. That the ability to put together a source of these documents in its entirety is just unbelievable.
And ultimately, it fails the big test, and that is, if you were to leak this, it draws a tremendous amount of attention to Area 51 S4 or to the entire program. If I was the KGB, I would say, wow, this is pretty interesting. They're really working hard at this. Let's go sign another 20 agents to penetrate White Sands and Los Alamos and the Air Force Academy, and just let's up our spying effort, because this is the Holy Grail. Forget, you know, transistors and stealing industrial stuff. We want the alien secrets.
Exactly. What surprises you the most, Bob, of these documents?
Well, the thing that impresses me the most, frankly, is the not well-known fact that during the Battle of L.A. in 1942, we recovered two craft, and those craft resulted in correspondence with between FDR and George Marshall, the chief of staff at the time, which in turn led to communication to set up a special non-terrestrial investigation committee in 1944, which then was told to Harry Truman in 1947. So that history between 42 and 47 that was going on behind the scenes is, I think, the most exciting part that's not known generally by the public.
Do we know where they picked up the craft? I mean, did it crash into the Pacific or what?
Well, there were two craft that were shot down that night. One was salvaged by the Navy at sea, and the other was picked up by the Army in the San Bernardino Mountains. And both the recovery of these craft led to a secret statement by Marshall saying that we'd fired 1,430 rounds and nothing had been recovered. But a top secret letter went from him to FDR, and FDR wrote to him and told him that we were going to start a program, Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, that would cover all of the incidents from 1897 on up. And then FDR established a special committee on non-terrestrial science and technology in 1944, where they had apparently asked for more money to figure out how they work. And he said, no, we've got to win the war first. But after that, why, it makes sense. And then later on, why Vannevar Bush wrote to Harry Truman, who at that time, in July 5th, 1947, was in charge, and said, you know, you may not have known about this, Mr. Truman, but this is what happened during the war, and now these guys want more money to go study this problem of the recovered craft. And so, see, that's a little history of correspondence that is just totally unknown by the UFO community.
No, that's true. You're absolutely right, Bob. And why is that? I mean, why don't they probe these things?
Well, we're trying to get it out to the world. It's on our website, I think. Right, Ryan? Right. We've got those documents there.
Yeah, we do. And I think it's of note that this earlier Marshall letter to the president started the research in 1897, which is the alleged Aurora, Texas UFO crash, that first date. But we're doing our best to try to get it out and keep researching it and getting more documents. What we need is more evidence, more witnesses, and more money, really.
Well, I got a letter, as I said, just the other day from the son of a pilot, and he alluded to correspondence that he'd had with respect to the recovery of the bodies from the Navy recovered in 1942. And apparently these recovered aliens were tall Nordics, 7 feet tall, and they had been sent to Wright-Patterson, and they were being analyzed by Eric Henry Wang, who was in charge of them. And they had been making measurements on the histonic weight, which has to do with a protein that's related to DNA. And the weight was so low that the guy who was making the measurements said, can I see the specimen from which this came? And so they took him in, and here he saw these two Nordic aliens that were dead. So this is very exciting to me because it's brand new, and it's it's just the son of a firsthand report. And it has to do with the 1942 recovery, which is very exciting. And also identifies a different shape of alien, the Nordic shape.
And you're right, Bob and Ryan. It's got to be now the family members, because even if somebody was 25 years old during that time period, I mean, they're in their mid-80s now.
Oh, yeah, right.
We'll be back with Bob Wood, Ryan Wood, on Coast to Coast AM as we continue talking about these documents. Unbelievable, huh?